everyone. It's time for another episode of the podcast. And this week, I interview Corey Rozenke. And Corey, we just had the best conversation. I know I say that every single week, but somehow I keep finding these truly incredible human beings. And guess what? They're so willing to be guinea pigs for the pod. I was super excited to meet Corey because Corey has released a new book called The Magnetic Heart of God. And really talking to Corey was super enchanting. Corey grew up in British Columbia, Canada. So we had kind of a conversation about the Maritimes and Prince Edward Island. We talked a little bit about Anne of Green Gables and how much we love L.M. Montgomery. Corey also grew up surrounded and enraptured by books. So we both had that in common. And you know, I love a good bibliophile. I'm all about it. And just hearing Corey's story, because you know, most times I know nothing about my guests, but Corey truly has emerged out of a very challenging life, a very challenging childhood, into creating something beautiful for people. And this book, The Magnetic Heart of God, it talks about our souls. And so we talk about that a little bit, or a lot of bit, in this episode. And you know, I'm all about listening to our souls. And you know, kind of one of the things I keep bringing up in this podcast is that if we had some more quiet time, if we appreciated the silence in our lives, perhaps we would more readily find our paths in life, find the way that our soul or God or universe or spirit is directing us. And Corey's book is kind of a guidebook for listening to the soul and getting back to truth and authenticity. So without further ado, here's my really seriously wonderful conversation with Corey.
I remember leaving the city and it was an hour and a half, looking at the clock, and it was 10:01, something like it was 10:01 or 11:01. Anyway, I believe it was 10:01. And I prayed and I said, Lord, it's wintertime. I don't know how I'm going to go home. Like, just get me home safe. And I remember the next thing I remember, I should say, was my signal light was on and I was turning into the driveway and I looked at the clock and it was 10:14. And somehow I had gone an hour and a half and 13 minutes. Right. And so look, I remember at the time being like, oh my gosh, I just experienced a miracle.
How do you self-describe?
Yeah, I understand why that stumps people, because the way I would answer that question over the years has changed dramatically. And I think the reason it's changed is because we live in a world today, I think, who has forgotten what it means to be human. And so when you ask the question, you know, who are you as a human being? I think we've been detached from our humanity in the sense where in our modern society, we have almost come to exclusively view ourselves as biological and psychological. We view ourselves as bodies and brains. And everything in our culture, everything in our society, from the school system to our governments to the commercials on TV, are all designed to promise us satisfaction for our bodies and our brains. And so we have somehow come to view ourselves as simply biological beings. And so I can imagine a lot of people who would describe themselves, when you ask that question, it would be linked to some sort of academia, something psychological or biological, physical, you know, what they do or what they like. And so as I've evolved over time in my understanding and my insight of what it means to be human, I answer the question differently. Because more than brains or bodies, we are souls. And this is something that we've known throughout the entirety of the human race. It's only in recent times that we've forgotten this, right? And I would say we it's true that we have forgotten it. It's not like we've suddenly had this new scientific revelation that we're like, oh, we don't have souls. No, in fact, very much the opposite. If you look into the evidence of the soul, it is a very scientific fact that we are souls. So we are three-part beings, body, mind, and soul. And so when I give you my answer, I have to take into account those three things. And so I guess I'm rambling on to what might be a simple question, but I would say, in light of the fact that more than a brain or a body, I'm a soul, I would say I'm a curious soul. I'm a curious soul, and I have been since I was very little. I've wanted to understand why. I've wanted to understand the deep why. So I'm the person, as I said, at the party, as you mentioned, I'm the person who will get deep really fast because I'm very curious as to what makes you tick. I'm very curious as to why this party is even happening. I'm very curious as to why one couple was going home at 9 and the other doesn't want to go home until 1 in the morning. And so I'm that person. I'm a curious soul. I guess that's how I would describe myself. Sorry for the long answer.
I love long answers. Thank you. I do think, you know, because I'm endlessly curious, and it's something that is innate within us, I believe, because as a child, just could not get enough of science magazines. And I didn't know why I had this compulsion. But then as I got old, I mean, I was also a voracious reader of everything else as well. But science, like my dad, when I was a teen, prescribed to a science magazine for me. And so I just want to know about the world, but I want to know about other people. And I think it kind of manifests as kids. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say is, like, as a kid, you were just as curious.
Yeah, I was raised very poor. In fact, there was years in there where we were homeless. A segment of time where we lived way up on a mountaintop, literally a mountaintop in a log cabin, no power, no running water. I remember my brother and I, us boys, had to bathe in the waterfall that was about 200 yards from the house. And for the girls, we would get water into a bathtub and heat it up on the stove and that kind of thing. But I wandered the mountain sides, just wandered searching, seeking to discover, oh, I have so many things that I found. I mean, secrets that are kind of just for me to a certain degree I'm talking about like as a 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 year old. So very young. But then I also took my books with me. And so for me, reading was a huge part of that curiosity. And I remember I would just wander away sometimes for days at a time. I can't believe my parents let me do this looking back at it. I would just camp out in the forest and, but I have my books with me and, very young, I was reading Plato, Aristotle, Plutarch, and, Marcus Aurelius, one of my favorites. And it was kind of one of those things where I would just sit against a tree on a mountainside. Nobody knew where I was and just be swept away into other worlds, you know, through reading and just that curiosity that this led me through life. And I often will talk about, you know, that curiosity really led me to philosophy. Philosophy led me to psychology. Psychology led me to neuroscience. Ultimately, I found that the answer to why isn't in any of those three places. Ultimately, philosophy, psychology, and neuroscience is the study of mechanism. And I wanted to understand source.
To tell you, I move every once in a while, and I mean, books are so precious to me. And, you know, people will say to me, hey, you know, I have bookshelves filled with books, and each one is, I have a distinct memory of why I revel in it, why I relish it, a place that I read it, what it evoked for me. And they say, you know, I mean, could you like give away some of these things? Like, you know, just like donate a few. And I'm like, are you joking? That's like part of me. Do you feel the same way?
Oh yeah, they're old friends, you know, and to a certain degree, I would even say, and people kind of think it's strange when I say this, but if I really think about it, I would say that I was raised by authors or by characters, you know, more than I can think of, you know, having my personality or my ethic shaped by my parents. It really was shaped by C.S. Lewis. You know, and as I mentioned, you know, Aristotle and Plato, and there was a while where I was into old Western books. That was kind of the one kind of guilty pleasure that I had. And so I think of Louis L'Amour books and the characters within those books, right? I would say, you know, it's like I was really influenced by Tyrell Sackett and you know, in different characters. Like when I look back and I really kind of try to delve deep into myself, I really feel that way.
Yes. Good answer. I'm just so curious. There's that word again. When you were a kiddo and you were, you know, I don't know your state of mind, but was there any sense, you know, like when you were living in that cabin on the mountain, that your childhood was kind of singular, that it was different, that it was not what other kids were experiencing? Did you get a sense of that?
Very much so. And I would say that was probably part of my curiosity, right? Why do we live this way and no one else does? Why do they go on vacations to Disneyland and it's even a foreign concept to me? Why are they engaged in these after school sporting activities? You know, and I'm just wandering the forest. You know, definitely. And I never felt, I would say that, I don't know if this was healthy at the time, but definitely the way I coped with being so different. As an example, so if you look at me and you see the way I look now, as we start talking, I'm Norwegian, right? In school, they called me the Indian. That was the way people referred to me. That was, and the reason was I grew up in the forest. I wore moccasins to school. You know, I came with saddlebags kind of thrown over my shoulder. I was just very much an outsider. Not unpopular, not never was I sitting alone. I was always in the thick of things, but definitely a different, right? And I wondered why. And that really kind of what led me into all these curiosities was, why are we so different?
I have to tell you that I would rather wander the forest than go to Disney World. Have to put that out there. So, and I do think, you know, especially as a child, when you're out in nature, when you're out in the woods, when you're having these kind of personal encounters out there with what have you, that is a really charmed and powerful place to be. Because as you're a kid, I mean, I'm going to project on you for a second. Okay. I completely, as a child, felt so much more connected to the living world around me than I do now. And I would expect or suspect that when you were in those woods reading a book or wandering or walking, that you were having conversations with nature all around you. Am I assuming too much, or am I on something?
I think that's very accurate. I mean, I'll tell you two quick stories. One of them, I remember I found a small lake in a little meadow. And I found a log cabin that had been burned down. And so there was just the two bottom layers of logs left. And you could tell it had been burned. And in the middle of the cabin were trees. And the trees were almost 2 feet in diameter. So this was Canada. I grew up in Canada and then now I live in the United States. So judging by the trees in the middle of that cabin, it burned down like around 200 years prior. And so you think, wow, this cabin was clearly built in the 1700s in the interior of British Columbia. What's the story? What happened here by this little lake 200 years ago? And then I remember just it being a real precious place to me, and nobody else knew that it was there, at least not that I knew of. And there was a little creek close by, and I remember I saw a little piece of metal sticking out by the creek. And so I started to dig, and I found this settler's toy. It was a covered wagon, probably about 24 inches long. You could tell it had been made out of forged steel. And it was clearly a toy of some settler, like I said, back in the 1700s, just buried there in the creek bank. And I remember that was just my place, and I didn't want to share it with anybody. It was that place where there was this intrigue, there was this mystery, and I almost felt like a relationship with people I didn't know from 100 years ago, just this connection. And I remember, I mean, looking back, maybe I would have done things differently, but at the time, I put the covered wagon back in the ground, I pulled the dirt back over it, and I told nobody. And then years later, I went back with my children, like 20 years later, and tried to find it again. And long since fires had gone through there, there have been flash floods. There's no hope of ever finding it again. And I'm kind of glad I didn't, almost, you know, because that was a very specific memory that was mine. And another quick one at that same lake, I remember going back to it one winter's night, and it froze over in the wintertime. And I had seen tracks of wolves that would go out into the middle of the lake. So I'm like, I want to watch it, go down there and see what those wolves are doing. So there was like a cliff on the edge of the lake. And I remember it was middle of winter, Canada, you know, 3 feet of snow. And I remember climbing up on the cliff's edge, you know, so I could look over the lake as the sun was going down, and just waiting, just laying there in the snow. And then slowly, you know, in that twilight and that dark, you just see movement across the lake and a wolf comes out, right? And then goes to the middle of the lake. And then there's movement in the other direction. They come out and then they start to howl, you know, just on the frozen lake. And I'm just there observing it, just soaking it in. And it is definitely more than just a biological experience, right? There's something deeper to it. And I have so many stories like that, but they're just are precious to me that only I experienced. I didn't get to share them with anyone. And sometimes I regret that. There are people I want to share things with, you know, but at other times it's like, wow, that was, those were things that I didn't just experience. Those were things that shaped me.
I'm a little bit envious right now about your childhood, even though it was obviously there was struggle and privation and that kind of stuff. So
definitely. And so there, I mean, when I think of the coping mechanisms that I made, right? So it wasn't all, you know, healthy, just this happy boy bouncing around the forest. There was different types of, you know, heartache and hurt. And to a certain degree, I remember for years, as a coping mechanism, I kind of felt like poverty was a badge of honor. And it isn't. I mean, you can be rich and honorable and poor and honorable. But I had in my mind, the way I coped with it was, you know, people who go on vacations, those are sissies. They're not tough like us, right? It kind of developed this kind of ego that had that. And it wasn't until I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s, where I was like, you know what? Wow, this is actually unhealthy. And I need to think things differently in this regard.
Thank you for that clarification. I really appreciate it. I think thoughts like that can kind of sneak up on us unawares and become a part of our way of being in the world without us even realizing it. And then one day you kind of have this epiphany or realization, if you're lucky. So then you can start engaging with the world in a way that allows for abundance. So, but I'm curious, did you grow up in a religious household or what did that look like for your family?
Yeah, definitely. Grew up in a Christian family. And I would say that very, very much not the kind of faith background that was, you know, traditional, but one that was active and real. That was a great source of comfort for me. I feel like whether people are missing out. Not only that I think they're missing out, but obviously I believe it's deeper than that. I feel like we're forgetting what it means to be human. But I feel that way when people don't have a sense of faith, a sense of a knowledge that there is more than just what I see around me, right? The circumstance is bigger. And so I would say that definitely carried me through as well. A lot of my experiences and even a lot of my lonely experiences was the realization that I wasn't alone.
And you were talking about being on this, you know, in this cabin on this mountaintop. And so did you all have like a home church at home when you were, was it pretty remote or did you go into town or what did that look like?
Yeah. So we would travel down the mountainside. Yeah. To church on Sunday. It was a very unique experience in that it was 3 miles to walk down to where I could catch the school bus. And so the school bus did come up to the, you know, up the mountain a ways and, but 3 miles down to the school bus and then back up. And I remember I loved it. I mean, it was like, I was that just bouncing boy, just bouncing through the forest, just happy as a clam. My sister did not love it as much as I did. But yeah, same thing when it came to church, it would be, you know, a 45 minute drive, you know, down the mountainside.
I love that you illustrated the difference between you and your sister.
Yeah. My mom always remarked on that because I look back at those years just with love and, you know, reminiscence and my sister is just trying to forget.
I mean, I think that's really interesting because one would presume that mostly you both had the same experiences, but just, you know, maybe she didn't go on long walks with books in the woods. It seems like you created a relationship or relatedness with what was around you, you know, yeah. And it was balm for your soul. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, I would say it was very much that way. You know, I have now live in California and I have people who will talk about the cold weather of Canada and how that must have been a real experience. And I always tell them, if you dress for the cold and you go with the mindset that you're in a winter climate and you're going to enjoy it. So you're going to do winter things, right? You're going to go sledding. You're going to go skiing, right? You're going to have those campfires and roast hot dogs with your big furry coats, and you embrace that. It is a delightful life. It is wonderful. But if you don't, if you go in it where it's like, oh, I don't want to be cold, right? I think you're going to hate life. I would say to a certain degree, that's what happened with my sister and I. You know, she was kind of living, she wanted to be a town girl, and just hang out with her friends, you know, kind of scenario, and chase boys. And whereas I was just like, well, we live in a cabin on the mountainside. I guess I'm going to become Grizzly Adams, you know, and that's what I embraced. And so I loved it. But I did have really long, you know, I'm a pretty blonde person, you know, but, you know, when I was a kid, I had even more hair and it was long and I would tie feathers. And there's a lot of reasons why they called me Indian, right? But it was, you know, because I just embraced that lifestyle. That's who I was at the time.
I did not factor in that the fact you would walk 3 miles and be happy about it to get to your worship service. So you are made of stouter stuff than I would have been complaining probably. Maybe there would be a lot of whining. To be honest, there would be some major whining on my part.
Well, I remember when I had some friends come up, you know, one friend in particular, and it was what didn't happen very often, but he'd come up and he would just be scared to death. You know, we weren't just wandering the forest. We were always coming into bumping into bears and cougars and stuff like that. And I had learned, you know, that the saying is true. You know, they're more scared of you than you are of them. And if you behave appropriately, it's fine. But it would just terrify him. You know, we'd go spend the night out in the wilderness. He just couldn't sleep all night. Every little sound, he'd be twitching. But then the funny thing was the reverse was also true. When I go down and visit him, you know, we'd go walking in the city at night and I would just be like all alert and just very different experiences.
That is so interesting. I'm sure that I already know the answer to this question, but did growing up, you know, especially on that mountaintop, did growing up in that space out in nature kind of forever change the way you relate to the natural world?
I would say so. I would say I very much subscribe to the idea that we are so bogged down with noise and activity, and that noise and activity forces us, our minds, to go in a million different directions. And so I think even today, if you truly want to find that place of clear thinking, of deep pondering, there's a reason why people get away on a writer's retreat, right? Or something and the writer's retreat is generally not downtown. You know, it's generally in some, you know, rural place. Definitely there's this, I just have this sense of awesomeness and wholeness of home, you know, when I'm in the remotest of places. I would say that that's where I feel the word home best describes that.
It's interesting. I just, you know, I've kind of lived alone off and on for decades just because I love silence and I love, you know, coming home after work and just that time of solitude and kind of recalibrating how my body is and my mind is. It has been so essential for me to be peaceful or not be triggered by the world. And I've recently had to move home to help my mother with a whole lot of things. My stepfather just passed away. And so it's been, I think I'm month 4 of living with her, but I have not lived with anyone for ever. And it is a totally different experience. And so, I mean, I've had to more intentionally find spaces where I can just have some silence and have some peace. And, you know, I meditate now before I go to sleep, and because, you know, it's good for my heart and soul to have that restful space. Mm-hmm. There's also a sense of the infinite inside that space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was listening to you talking and you're so right. People today are, you know, it's like, how many distractions can we fit into our day? Mm-hmm. Whether it's TikTok or meeting someone for coffee, or not that any of these things are negative in small doses, but we really have become a world, or, you know, an American culture where we want to be distracted. And I always feel like we want to distract ourselves so we don't have to attend to our grief, because so many people that I know are carrying such profound sorrow. That's kind of like this. I always think about, you know, when you're behind a big truck and there's a huge slushy snowstorm and it goes through a puddle and it throws all that gross stuff on your windshield. It kind of splats on it. And you're like, oh my gosh, we're on the highway. I can't see. And you put the windshield wipers on, but it's grimy for a while. It's almost like the sorrow is like, it's like splattered onto us and we don't want to engage with it because it's work, because we're busy, but we keep ourselves busy so that we don't have to think about it. Yeah. I'm thinking about and reflecting on your childhood and just kind of the conversation that we've been having so far about the soul. And for me, like quiet spaces and places, because you need to not be distracted to tend to what your soul's trying to tell you, because, you know, everybody's like, oh, listen to your intuition. If you're distracted and like filling your day with tons of minutiae of things that will take your mind off your life, how are you even going to connect? How are you even going to listen to what's being said to you? Mm-hmm. And so I really do so much appreciate you bringing that up about us leading these lives where there are no spaces and places for us to kind of disconnect unless we're super intentional about it.
Well, and I would say that even entertainment has taken the place of peace. And it can never really take its place. It's a cheap knockoff. It's a cheap substitute that doesn't really work, right? But you're right. We pursue more noise and more entertainment in lieu of actual joy and actual peace. And you said something. You talked about everyone being depressed or discouraged. That is not, I believe, that's not just your opinion. That is a statistical fact. You know, the reason I think we're in the trouble we are in is, I mean, we think about this. We are literally the most prosperous generation in the history of the world. Never before in the history of mankind has a generation like the generations alive today been granted access to wealth opportunities, education, comfort, leisure, entertainment, world travel. No generation in the history of the world has had the opportunity that we have. And yet virtually every study shows that we're more depressed than ever. We're angry despite our, you know, I remember like 10 years ago, it was all about education. If people would just get educated, we'd live in this kumbaya society. Well, education is available, especially through online, everywhere now. We're not happy, right? And I think the reason has been we've forgotten what it means to be human, right? We're like, satisfy the body, satisfy the brain. And it's not enough because that's not the core of who we are. But we've been told, I would say, for thousands of years, you know what? If you'll just reach the top of that educational mountain, you'll have peace. Or you get to the top of that sexual mountain or the top of that financial mountain or whatever, you'll have peace. But ours is the generation who has been blessed with so much that we've reached the summit and we've discovered there's nothing there. I saw an interview with Elon Musk a few months ago. As far as we know, the richest man who's ever lived. And the interviewer asked him, are you happy? Simple question. And Elon, in his Elon-type way, you know, he pauses and he thinks for a moment. And then he says, I don't think many people would want to be me. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's not the answer I want to hear. The richest man who ever lived can't say he's happy. No, he has everything the world has to offer in a biological sense, right? Or even in an academic sense. And yet he's not. And Jim Carrey, you know, the Canadian comedian, I heard him a little while ago. He said, I wish that everybody could experience riches and fame so that they would realize that's not the answer. Right? But we in this world today, we're all in pursuit of it. If I just get enough money, I'll be happy. Right? If I just get in the not enough power and control, I'll be happy. If I just get this extra freedom, if I can have some more freedom, I'll be happy. And it's all proven to be false because we're pursuing all these biological and psychological cravings. Meanwhile, the cravings of our soul, unsatisfied, and we're starving. We're sitting on top of a pile of ever-increasing biological things, possessions, and starving to death.
Thank you.
how did you have the, inspiration or compulsion to, because writing something is no joke. It is, it's hard work. It takes time, especially for a subject that's as serious as yours, because I do think it's a serious subject. How did this come about?
Ultimately, going back to that boy wondering why, you know, and this long journey now of, like I said, philosophy didn't have the answer. Psychology doesn't have the answer. Neuroscience doesn't have the answer. Ultimately, at the end of the day, science doesn't have the answer because science, we've forgotten this, is limited to what we can observe and verify, right? And so when it comes to certain aspects, you know, science has its, definitely has its place necessary, but it can't answer the question why, because science needs something to view, right? And ultimately, it's been my search of understanding of human behavior and why we do what we do, and a lifetime of study and research and schooling. And we have this idea, I think most of us, even though the vast majority of people statistically believe we have a soul, it's an ambiguous soul, right? It's a soul that, and to a certain degree, I think we believe that, you know, it doesn't really activate until we die. And then somehow it awakens. When I would say the exact opposite is the truth. Your soul is the core of who you are. It is the center of your personality. It is the source of your motivation. If you want to understand why people do what they do, you get a deeper, more thorough answer by understanding the soul than you do, you know, biological things. And that's my book is titled The Magnetic Heart of God, Understanding the Five Cravings of Your Soul. And in the book, I put forth that our souls can be understood by five specific cravings that are at the root of all other human ambition. It all the beauty of this is it shows and it reveals that we are all united in this particular area. If we look at each other biologically, we're different. And then we get divided over these biological differences, even psychological differences. But when we understand that we are souls and that these souls, just like our bodies, they're looking for something, they're craving something, then I can begin to understand you. And so in the book, I break down these five particular cravings of the soul. I mean, I can just run through them quickly, but security, identity, independence, significance, innocence. These are at the root of all human ambition, all human thought. They're the reason why some people are desperate to get married. They're the reason why people are desperate to get divorced. You know, they're the reason we pursue different academic or career options. And so really what I try to do in the book is break down in a non-ambiguous way. As I mentioned, we tend to view the world, words like soul as ambiguous, or even words like peace as ambiguous, or happiness as ambiguous, almost like we individually define them. I would say that that is a fallacy, that peace and happiness have five prerequisites, and they happen to be connected to the cravings of the soul. And so really what I try to do is give people definition. Because as long as we're chasing something ambiguous, we can never find it. Because we can't recognize it even if we saw it. You know, we need a clear target. And so that's what I try to do in the book, is to say, hey, listen, the reason your sister isn't talking to you, you know, there are all sorts of circumstantial issues, maybe words were said and all this stuff. Granted, all that's very true. And you may have to sort through that. But at the end of the day, I can tell you it has something to do with this. It has something to do with security or identity or independence, significance, innocence. Somehow you trigger her in that regard. And it's a craving of the soul that has to be satisfied. And that's what's propelling us all through life and time. That's why it's never enough. Have you ever noticed? It's like you just think, if I could make 30 grand a year, I could be happy. Oh, then you make 30 grand a year, and guess what? Oh, now if I could just get 35, right? And then just keeps climbing until suddenly you're making $250,000 a year, and you're still saying to yourself, if I could just make 300,000, I'd be happy. Because we're trying to fill a non-biological craving with biological things or psychological things.
Well, I would love love to hear any like a story or stories that you have experienced or even just witnessed where you feel like you've witnessed something that was magical or miraculous in your life, something, you know, that changed your life forever, the life of someone else, whatever you feel safe or good enough about sharing.
Yeah. Well, I guess the first one I would say would be, well, maybe they're both connected to faith, but I would say I've had a couple experiences, you know, and it's very interesting when you get into the miraculous, how if you're not careful, over time you lose the miracle. Like, well, in the sense that over time you begin to question the experience. And that, and there's you know, validity to that, you know, because in one hand there's the saying that says the man with an experience is never at the mercy of a man with an argument, right? Meaning that if I had the experience, it doesn't matter how much you argue against the impossibility of it, I had the experience, you know, so too bad. But on the flip side of that, there's the saying that says that experience is the mother of illusion. And that is to say, ultimately, at the end of the day, experience is largely founded upon perspective. And so what kind of perspective did you have entering it? And number two, oftentimes that can evolve over time. And so true experience can become myth, but we can't let that hold us back from remembering the miracle. So I'll give you a quick example. I remember one time, and I'm just sharing my experience, right? I remember one time being in a city called Red Deer, Alberta, and it was late at night and I had an hour and a half drive, and I was dead tired. Just utterly exhausted. And I remember leaving the city and it was an hour and a half, looking at the clock, and it was 10:01, something like it was 10:01 or 11:01. Anyway, I believe it was 10:01. And I prayed and I said, Lord, it's wintertime. I don't know how I'm going to go home. Like, just get me home safe. And I remember the next thing I remember, I should say, was my signal light was on and I was turning into the driveway and I looked at the clock and it was 10:14. And somehow I had gone an hour and a half and 13 minutes. Right. And so look, I remember at the time being like, oh my gosh, I just experienced a miracle. And, you know, of course, over time your brain goes, did that really happen? Did I really have that experience? Right. I know I did, you know, that's exactly what happened. I have several stories like that, but I would say, you know, and maybe I'm going to bore you with this, but I would say the biggest miracles that I've seen and experienced have been heart changes, right? When you see a healthy person, I want to clarify that, forgive what most of us would consider unforgivable. That's a miracle. And it's beautiful, right? I've seen people lost in desperate addiction suddenly, through work as well, through hard work as well and choices, but get healed and healthy. And it's like, that's a miracle. When you see, my point being, when you see someone change in a way that the world either thinks is impossible or in some cases even thinks shouldn't happen, right? That's a miracle. I mean, even in my own life, I think I used to be, if I'm honest, and this is hard to admit, because of my upbringing that we talked about, it turned me into a very self-reliant person. And as a self-reliant person, I had to become very closed to protect myself. And to be honest, judgmental and condescending. And so to see, I would say that it was more an act of a miracle than an act of behavior modification on my part, where I can see today how I love people now in a way that I could never have imagined in my 20s and early 30s. And I would call that a miracle. I would call that a transformative miracle. Again, I don't know if that bores you, but that type of thing. But that would be, I would say those things to me have been profound. And I've seen that over and over again in life. People, I've seen stories where people have been healed, right? And it's been a beautiful thing. But bigger than any of that biological stuff, right? It's more that soul issue where I've seen people transformed inside. And so as a result, I don't throw anybody away. I think I'd say the miracles that I've seen have done two things for me. Number one, I believe that all things are possible. And that is a delight to go through life knowing all things are possible. There's so many people out there who don't have that privilege or that blessing. So all things are possible. And number two, I don't throw anybody away. Nobody is beyond redemption or beyond wholeness. Everybody can come back to the place they need to be.
That's episode 156 and my really great conversation with Corey. There will be a link to Corey's website in the episode show notes, as well as complete attribution for the music used. But getting back to Corey, on the Treasures page of the website, there will be a link to his book so that you can check it out and possibly purchase it. I need to thank Corey for telling all of his stories and for being such a gracious guest. Remember, listeners, it's all about the ratings and reviews, so please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. I am so grateful to each and every one of you that does that, and it makes my heart sing and helps me to keep going. So thanks to all of you who have left a rating or written a little review. And remember, everybody, producing this podcast does cost money. And so if you consider it, please do think about supporting me on Patreon. That's Patreon. Every month, you can support me for either $3, $5, or $10 a month. And that helps me defray some of the cost of producing the pod, because it does cost money. I'm so very grateful to those of you that already support me. You have no idea what your support means to me. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Corey. Read books. Get addicted by the stories out there. How can you live into the stories that you're reading? Whether it's Moby Dick and the tale of the white whale, or Peter Rabbit and the story of Mr. McGregor and his garden, or even a comic book or graphic novel. What is your story and how are you living it in the world? Corey and I talked a little bit about how much we loved Anne of Green Gables. And I told him partially it was because the author does such an incredible job talking about how gorgeous Prince Edward Island is. And those kind of gorgeous words and her imagery really caught me when I was a child and brought so much beauty to my life. So what books bring beauty to you? What books open your mind and open your soul? Because really, it's all about the soul at the end. And so be like Corey, have a conversation with your soul and do it every day. And pretty soon, I'm guessing, you're going to be more open to the beauty, more open to the people, and more open to the path that you should be living in this world. Thank you for listening, and I'll be seeing you so very soon with another episode of the podcast.